And how did you come across me?
Nutrition's been like a interest area, I guess. So I guess, yeah, we can start with that. Okay, perfect. So is it okay if I call you Brooke?
Yeah.
Okay, Brooke, it's very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Nathan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Yeah. I came across you just because it's a passion area of mine a little bit right now, especially. And I don't even know if I can call myself this, but I practice like amateur bodybuilding, mm-hmm. I guess, is like the way I train in the gym.
Yeah.
And so it's not as much now, but for quite a long time, I was taking my diet very seriously and I had a coach and we're going over everything. And mm-hmm. I just got, the more and more I got into it, the more and more I got obsessed with just everything. So you start with like calories and then it's macros and then it's micronutrients. And then you're starting to, you get to the point where you're like meal prepping for based on your energy to get into the gym.
Yes.
And then trying to like make sure this, you get into the minutia too, of like trying to make sure you hit like your protein goal at the right times of day after the gym and stuff like that. And so just looking into that universe, and I came across you just Googling. And so, and I read your website and then found your bio. And I was doing a little bit of prep last night as well. And I thought, I was like, oh my goodness, I could talk to her for hours. It seems like you've got a lot of information in your background there.
Yeah, so. I do actually. Yeah, I think I do. You know, after 14 years as a dietitian, and I lots and lots of interest areas, really. But yeah, I'm sure we'll get into it.
Yeah, I'd like to cover as much as we can. So you are the CEO of Food to Fit Nutrition, and mm-hmm. you've got a location here in Saskatoon and one in Regina.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
You started as well, or did you become the CEO after the fact?
I took over the business. It will be 12 years ago in March.
Okay,
so
cool.
It was a very small business, single dietitian. And so I joined that dietitian, but then, you know, that they wanted to cut their ties with mm-hmm. a lot of different things and move on to a new opportunity. So I sort of jumped at this opportunity to take over a private practice, had no idea what I was getting into. Really didn't have a lot of mentorship, although I did soon after seek out mentorship from different private practice dietitians throughout, you know, whether it mostly in Calgary, but and then very quickly realized that there is a small but very quickly growing community of private practice dietitians throughout Canada. So I had no idea what my niche was, what area I wanted to work in. I wanted to originally work in sport and be a sport dietitian. And it just wasn't going to kind of work out the way I wanted it to. So the opportunities, I think, were limited. And the Sport Med and Science Council has a dietitian, and I think that's where a lot of the elite athletes would access. So in terms of private, I didn't really think it was going to be super lucrative. And I didn't necessarily want to just be working with folks who were, you know, at the gym and had an interest in changing their body composition.
Yeah.
I also very quickly realized how disordered that can get and how much fixation there can be on the gram amounts and the macros and a lot of specifics, but it felt very disordered for me, and I really struggled with that. So over the years, found a niche. Now we have two offices in Saskatoon and one in Regina. So there are 8 of us dietitians and a social worker.
Okay.
Yes, and a student who helps with our social media.
Okay. Well, why a social worker?
That's a great question. For a while I had been, you know, just figuring out whether or not we wanted to add a social worker to the team. And I think predominantly it was because we were more and more working with people with varying, I think, on the spectrum of disordered eating to diagnosed eating disorders. Mm. So we were seeing more and more people with really complex mental health and food relationship and eating disorders. So we thought that would be a good addition to the team. And then Monique knocked on my door and said, hey, would you ever consider hiring a social worker? So the stars aligned. I'd been sort of putting that energy out there, I guess, for some time. And then it was a really great fit.
Yeah.
So she's been with us for over 2 years. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's so interesting when stuff like that happens. You just have to like sit there and like just accept
manifest it.
Wow. Is it 2.5 years you said now?
Yes.
And has it been as beneficial as you hoped it would be?
Yeah, it's great to have somebody to refer to when we have our own clients or even plant a seed. And, you know, we're not necessarily referring all our clients to her, but even we do talk a lot about mental health. And where our scope of practice would stop is mostly just to inquire about how is your mood and mental health. Number one, to break the stigma and get chatting. And number two, to plant a seed if we think they could probably use some support from a therapist or counselor. And number three is because a person's mental health can really affect their capacity for putting meals together or for cooking or for prepping or for grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people who struggle with severe anxiety hate the grocery store. So, you know, there can be so many aspects. People who are neurodiverse experience, you know, have varying relationships to food. For example, what I'm learning is for some of my clients with ADHD, they really struggle to either pay attention and not be too distracted by other things.
Right.
So they struggle to tune into their hunger cues and eat and remember to eat. So many of them have really chaotic eating patterns.
Yeah.
Or just putting together what one might consider a basic meal can be very overwhelming. It's just what one might think of is three steps. You know, a person with ADHD could think that it's like 100 steps. Mm-hmm. And there's too many things to do before you get there. The other thing that I'm noticing too is medications, you know, can a person's appetite. And so then we're almost having to eat based on a clock rather than that internal cue of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
It can be just so far reaching. So we like to talk about mental health. And then, of course, we know that people are complex. And so sometimes talking about nutrition seems like a very straightforward thing, but it can just be, you know, the most, maybe you start unpacking and peeling back layers and it's like, wow, there's so much going on for you. And what they thought was maybe, for example, I hear all the time, I'm just lazy. And I hate that word. I think it's a really judgmental word that's produced by our society. And it's like, it's not lazy. Let's peel back that back. What is actually going on for you?
Mm-hmm.
And so then it's like, okay, there's a lot behind the scenes. Maybe working with a counselor can also in the long term support their nutrition or health goals as well. Because we know health comes in a package.
So. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, like you said, it's complicated. I would think too that a lot of people that think they're lazy probably just don't know what, like, they don't know what getting into all of this looks like, and then they know that they don't know, so it would, the dauntingness of it could make them feel like they're lazy, I would think.
Where do I even begin?
And so it's just an easy thing to say instead of like, no, you can do it too, you're not lazy. It's just, it's a little bit, it's daunting, like we said. On the medication front too, I would imagine that one's really, like, really difficult to overcome for a lot of people, just because, especially with something like ADHD, like, a lot of those stimulants not only are disrupting your neurochemistry a lot of the time and your mood, but your appetite is like perpetually suppressed a lot of the time, is it not?
For a lot of people. So what I'm learning, and again, this is just from practice experience and observation. Mm-hmm. I am not an expert in medications.
Fair enough.
But what I've come to learn is, for majority of people, ADHD medication can suppress the appetite, and especially with kids, you know, parents and their doctors are really sometimes concerned about weight loss and just trying to keep weight on. So we have to eat, you know, support their feeding in the windows that their appetite is stronger. And then just trying to get those more highly palatable foods that really hit the taste sensors. Yeah. But, you know, it is a challenge. For some people, appetite is not affected. Hmm. And they just really benefit from the medication in many different ways. So, the medications can really help as well, obviously, with impulse control, I've understood as well. And we know that there's actually a high correlation or association between ADHD and binge eating disorder, for example, or other eating disorders. Mm. So if there is, you know, really impulsive eating, and I think what I've come to learn is that some people will stimulate with food. So then that can sometimes lead them to just be stimming and snacking all day long. So the medication can sometimes help with that. Mm. However, if someone has binge eating disorder and the medication is suppressing their appetite, when that wears off in the evening, guess what? Yeah. You know, they're binging.
You kind of have like a rebound.
Yes. Yeah. So then we're having to make sure that even though you're not hungry, we need you to eat through the day and do some mechanical eating or based on the clock, mm-hmm. so that they're not really low. And then once that medication wears off, just famished, yeah. which would trigger a binge as well. So
wow. I never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's difficult, I would imagine, to be like not only want to fix your nutrition, then have all these other problems. And so it's cool. It's probably really rewarding working with everyone and kind of helping them get through these things.
Yeah. How do I feel about the word? I suppose I feel like, I guess it is rewarding. Of course it's rewarding. We love what we do. Mm-hmm. And I suppose what I'm feeling about that word is it selfish?
Yeah, fair enough.
And so very much the focus is on the client, mm-hmm. on their centeredness and is directed, you know, all our care is directed by them. So I know that we throw the word client-centered out a lot in our healthcare system. I like to use client-directed care. And so it is very much directed by them. They lead the way. I am just their guide mm-hmm. to the map, you know, and I'm there as a support on their journey. So, I suppose it could be rewarding, but I don't know if all the clients necessarily, I think they do, but it's really hard work, especially as we are working more for with people who are struggling with their food and body relationship. It can be such a difficult journey because of our society's mm-hmm. fixation and obsession on thinness and having the right body and, you know, fitting into a small box that most people don't actually fit into.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I could understand the feeling worried about the word. I do think it's important though. Like with a lot of things, anytime that, I think for a lot of professionals and with a lot of professionals with clients, because if something is not rewarding, even though it is selfish, like you said, if it's not at least rewarding, then it can almost, a lot of the times it can swing back to resentment, right?
And totally. So, oh, yes. Yeah. I'm sure it is. Yes, it must be. I do love the work that I do. I've just never thought of it as like for myself.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm not sure what that says about me. My own.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being selfless. So.
But I love what I do. And, you know, even though I run a multi-practitioner practice, which keeps me very busy, I do still love the one-to-one counseling and the frontline work, which is why I still do it. So certainly I dabble in other things like media, television, radio, writing, magazine interviews. But I really, really love the one-to-one counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you always know that you wanted to do it in that form? Or because, you know, you mentioned wanting to go into sports nutrition a little bit beforehand, but
yeah, I think I always, I always wanted to work one-to-one with folks. And I mean, there's multiple ways in a private practice, and many private practice dietitians have multiple income streams.
Hmm.
They're doing other media, they're doing sponsored content, they're, you know, working with brands, and they're writing books and they're maybe working in the agriculture industry or other areas. There's so many ways to make money. Some of them have excellent podcasts, but I'm not sure. You know what? It's been a journey, and I think I'm not sure I had a vision from the get-go. I just jumped in, and I figured it out as I went. Maybe isn't always the best way to go about business, but I think at the same time, if I waited until everything was perfectly aligned, I would still be working in the public sector, which I did also love and is absolutely necessary. But I knew my heart was, I knew my heart was running my own business.
Yeah.
And I knew my heart was just working with people in a different way, maybe digging deeper into their lives, spending more time with them, and working with people who weren't acutely ill, you know, as a little bit more of a preventative. But also, there's tons of gaps in the public healthcare system.
Yeah.
So trying to fill those gaps and then also get people connected into the public system where they need and when it's necessary. So I always wanted to maintain that integrity. It's not me versus acute care. It is how does private practice, you know, complement and work with.
It has to be a bit of a synergy, right?
Yeah. Our public health system. Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting too. When you mention gaps in the public health care system, I think a lot of people are noticing that, unfortunately, right now. And does it come up a lot in conversations, or is it just something you're noticing?
We do sometimes notice that because people don't know the healthcare system, and they don't always know the questions to ask in order to get access to the right even testing, or family doctors are hard to come by as well, and they are overworked. And I think they are, from what I've heard from other family physicians, they are seeing more complex patients as well. And then they have limited time with them. So sometimes patients don't know what to ask, or they're not sharing maybe the most pointed information to help the doctor really understand. So some of our role is to devise really direct questions that they can take back to their doctor so that, for example, I work a lot with people who have gut health issues, functional gut health issues like irritable bowel syndrome. So it's like, well, don't just tell your doctor you're bloated, because like that could be anywhere along the GI tract. Like where is that bloating? So, you know, helping to devise the specifics. And then, you know, it might be helpful based on your symptoms to inquire about a celiac screen or a calprotectin, or which are blood markers, or, you know, if we think that there might be something up with their thyroid or their iron levels. And so really just helping the client to create a bridge and a relationship with their doctor. So here's our assessment. We can send a report to your doctor. And then I encourage you to go have a conversation so that we're kind of bridging that gap and trying to create a team. And that's the thing, is private practice is so isolated.
Yeah.
So we really try to draw in the other healthcare providers.
Yeah, well, it's tough. It's because you can't know everything, and they can't know everything, right? And yeah, and of course, I'm not trying to put anybody down or talk negatively about any profession. But do you find that they kind of push back sometimes on what you're suggesting that people bring to them? Their family doctors?
No, but I think again, I was having this conversation with another dietitian recently, but I think what's important is that we have to understand the Saskatchewan healthcare system and where we're at. So as dietitians, even if there's a client who wants to explore something, sometimes we have to kind of talk them down to, well, here's the nature of things, here's what's available. And here's what I know. Here's what we generally don't know. There's like so much, and nutrition science, it's a really complicated area to test, because we can't just put people in, you know, an institute and you know, do unethical testing on them. even though that is what we technically had done in the residential school system. So totally appreciating that. So dietetics has a long way to unravel from that. However, yes, we really rely on epidemiological studies, which aren't the greatest. So there's tons that we don't know. And so, sorry, back to the question. I think it's just knowing the nature and what's available and then working within those limitations. Mm-hmm. So we can't be asking for, testing that's really out there. And certainly there are practitioners who might, engage in that, but that's just my own personal, I don't speak for other dietitians, but yeah. So
no, of course.
But no, I personally don't think, I think like any health professional, doctors will think critically and they know their patients and they might, deny a certain test. And I'm sure they have their rationale, of course, because we're not having these direct conversations necessarily with them. And that makes sense. Just like we have our rationale and we have our assessment. So all we can do is really write the assessment, give them some input and say, we wonder if it might be worthwhile to look into these tests. And then they might say, go with that or not. I find the better route is rather than me send a report to the doctor saying I recommend these tests, it's have the conversation with the patient and have them take in their list of questions and then say, the dietitian, based on her assessment, wondered if we should test blah, blah, blah for this reason. And I find if the client is having that conversation with their doctor, it goes over a little better than me just telling them, because they're like, who are you? And like, what is your assessment?
Yeah, so, exactly. I've had that experience a little bit myself too.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I have so much respect and I know that the healthcare system right now is very tender. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to be really patient and respectful of all modalities. And we have clients who are we see a lot of people who are just feeling really unheard, feeling lost, feeling gaslighted even, and not intentionally. I never think that a provider intends those things or harm, but that's how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. Because we spend so much time with our clients, I think we can be a bit of an advocate for them.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's one of the issues too, is about what somebody was trying to get across and what actually came across. Like, for example, I work in the financial services industry as an assistant, and I read a report a few weeks ago that said that financial services, it was somewhere in the top three of professions that's distrusted in Canada. And I think it's because it gets a really bad rap from stuff that happened in the past, and then also bad professionals. Because, for example, in the practice that I'm in, we've seen people come in that have been sold a product that, if you were following the regulatory guidelines, they should not have been sold. And then you find out that it's the type of product that the advisor that sold it to them got a very large commission. And so stuff like that happens. Sure. And then that person gives everybody a bad rap. They just think everybody thinks, well, like, no, they're only out to get your money and this, that, and they don't want to help.
Right.
And then there's practices like the one that I'm in, and that's all we're trying to do is help. And I think that the same thing happens in healthcare, and I would imagine in nutrition as well, mm-hmm. is that people mm-hmm. have this experience with one doctor and they think like, oh no, they're all like that. They're all dismissive. They're all terrible. And they make these blanket statements, but they're all just people ultimately. Like, I had to change family doctors in the last, I think like 4 years now. I've been kind of moving through, and I got a new one because mine retired and he did feel that way, like dismissive and not listening. So I was able to find a new one, luckily, and he's great. He listens. Good. And like you talked about being heard.
Yes.
But I think sometimes I do that a lot. We forget that this person is also a person, they've got their own ways of doing things. And just because you felt this way doesn't mean that all other doctors or all other registered dietitians are that way as well. They're all just trying to help. They're doing it their way.
Yeah. You hit on a couple of really important points. I think the first in our practice at Food to Fit Nutrition, we talk as a team about what it looks like to decolonize our practice. So we take things like social justice and anti-racism really seriously. And so in those talks, though, it is how can we I think, hear our clients and listen and basically not over talk over them. Mm-hmm. And so, and also I think the most important thing is how can we narrow the power gap? So for example, I am a white cisgender female of middle income, like there, and I'm, you know, neurotypical. Like I have, when you look at the power wheel, the only thing that I don't have is being male. Mm-hmm. So then it's like, okay, how can we narrow that gap? So one of the things that we've started practicing is, you know, when we first sit down with our clients, is say, you know, this is me, I'm a registered dietitian, blah, blah, blah. Do our introductions and say, I'm here to first listen to your story. So I'm going to hold some space for you. Tell me a little bit about why you're here. And I will believe you. Like that's, mm-hmm. And I think some people need to hear that. I believe you. Like, thank you for sharing. Yeah. I believe you, because I think not everyone feels believed. And no matter what's going on, it's like, okay, I believe you. And even if it's, if it could be psychosomatic or, you know, it's still something that is causing them maybe mm-hmm. distress. So there's that. But also, I am first, I tell my patients, my clients, I'm first human, I'm second dietitian. So this also alleviates the pressure on me to know everything, because yeah. I don't know everything. I don't know how nutrition interventions are going to work in your body. We do have a lot of science, and we practice from an evidence-based, you know, standpoint, or I guess, basis. And then obviously I have some practice-based knowledge with 14 years behind me. But first and foremost, I'm human, which means I might make mistakes, which means I'm also open to being corrected.
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't matter what it is. Like, just if the person is like, you know, I need to set a boundary with you, I don't feel comfortable with that question, you know, that feels whatever it may be. Like, just, I want them to feel safe and open to share.
Yeah.
So that I can learn and do better.
Yeah, know, exactly. Well,
to
then,
reduce harm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they feel more involved in what's going on as well. They don't feel like they're only being prescribed something, right? Like, you can actually work with them.
Mm-hmm. So that said, I totally recognize the privilege that we have in private practice, because again, like, every initial consultation is 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. Like, it's twice as long as you would get for most initial consultations yeah. with a dietitian within the system. So I think every practitioner is doing the best they have in the time slot that they have. I think there's a lot of pressures. I think there is, a lot of barriers to providing optimal care and, yeah, reducing harm. But, mm-hmm. yeah, so then we get blanket statements that may feel dismissive to a client or a patient.
Yeah. It's tough. It's like anything else in the world. You can't, no, none of us are perfect and can't do the job perfectly. Right. Mm. So,
yeah. And admitting that.
Yeah. Well, like you said, I think it's like you said, being human first and then a dietitian second, and going over that with clients. I would imagine that it's like, have you always done it that way? Told them that?
No. Oh gosh, no.
So I imagine there's probably a pretty stark contrast between before having that conversation and after, I would imagine.
Yes. Yeah. I would say even in the last 3-4 years, as a team, we've really dug in and had some hard conversations, but really explore trauma, what that means, what our clients are coming in with. And the reason we are here today is because of all the mistakes I've made. So I've had to really come full circle and make sure I'm practicing self-compassion, because I have made so many mistakes and no doubt have caused, you know, whatever level of harm to people, even, you know, emotional, just by not really knowing, you know. And so I think it's okay to know that we're human and we make mistakes, but we need to be open to correction and listening and recognizing when we do, and then course correcting.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm learning, and not to just get too hung up in our mistakes. But that is tough, because a lot of dietitians, myself including, are pretty type A perfectionist. So we see the harms of perfectionism when it comes to even how our clients eat and trying to be perfect with nutrition. Sometimes that can very quickly turn to disordered eating, but yeah, I'm only here because of all the mistakes I've kind of made along the way and because I continue to be open to learning and know that I don't know it all. Yeah.
Well, what are you, like, at the end of the day, what are you doing if you're not doing that, right? Because if you're, like, for anybody, if you're, like, 5, 10, 15 years down the line and you haven't made any mistakes and you haven't grown or changed at all, like, what are you, like, really, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and so, and this is a bit harsh, but I call them fake people. Like, I don't, like, they don't, because they don't seem real when you're talking to them. But the type of person that is always lying and not being honest or authentic, they always feel like they're trying to get something out of you, like conniving.
Mm-hmm.
But then they also need to be right. Mm-hmm. And everybody's had that experience with people, whether it be a friend or professional. And they feel fake. Like, they actually feel like they're not a real person that exists.
Mm-hmm.
So it's refreshing when you get into a setting, like I imagine your clients get into with you, and you're sitting down with a professional and you're like, oh my God, this is like an actual real person that wants to have a conversation with me, wants to help me. They're not just here with this facade in front of, between us, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, part of that client rapport building is to laugh with them and to share little tidbits about your life where you're comfortable to, you know, where, like, relate with them if that's makes sense, or even just like, you know, thank you for sharing. I've never experienced that myself, but I can imagine that was XYZ. I think it just takes a little bit to just listen and tell the client, I believe you mm-hmm. when you tell me that's hard, you know, instead of like, it's not hard, you're just not trying enough. Especially, so, I mean, I hear this a lot. I think, you know, the big reason a lot of people will see a dietitian is for health, which is a code word for weight loss.
Yeah.
And, so I think the obvious, or what I've come to learn from people, especially those with higher BMIs or in higher bodies, is this idea that, oh, you just haven't tried hard enough to lose weight, or it is incredibly bogus. And if given the choice, most people would not choose to be in a higher weight body. So I think there's a lot of assumptions that people choose to be in a higher weight body. But most people I see have tried multiple times in their lives, and sometimes it's a cycle of diet after diet after diet to lose weight. And we're finding in research that this is actually contributing to chronic disease, just that weight cycling and dieting is really hard on a person's health, mental and physical. So anyway, that is one example of just believing the patient and checking in on our biases and assumptions that we have, especially about weight, given our society's obsession with health is a weight, health is a size.
Is that still something that you're looking at with clients, right, though? Or is weight, like, ever part of the conversation?
Great question. Yeah. I just had a nutrition student, and I love having students because they bring a new perspective and they are so fresh, but they're also just very much part of, you know, society, and they're taking in everything. So they bring in a fresh look at what they're hearing and what they're learning. So the student said, I was pleasantly surprised that because you practice from a weight inclusive, or what we call health at every size, approach, that you do still engage conversations around weight loss. So I said, well, we can't expect, because our society is still very much like the weight normative approach, the approach to care is weight normative, like BMI is health, weight is health, size is health, and shrinking your body is always better, which is very untrue based on a lot of really good science. But that is kind of the bias and the consensus still. So I said, well, we can't not talk about weight loss. I mean, when our clients come in desiring it and wanting it, because it exists everywhere. So we have to support them through that. So we're very transparent based on what we know from experience and from science with our approach to care. You know, we are not going to risk a person's nutritional health or encourage restricted eating, which is disordered, or potentially cause harm, putting them at risk for an eating disorder. We know that dieting is one of the causes or one of the factors that can contribute to eating disorders. So, but we will hear them and hold space for their desires for weight loss. Right. We can't not. Who wouldn't desire weight loss? And even though, you know, for example, I've done a lot of work on, you know, accepting my size and shape changes over the year. Granted, I live within privilege, so that might be a little bit easier for someone like me. But still, it's not uncommon for people to have done the work and still have a level of concern about weight gain, you know, or, you know, still feel uncomfortable no matter how much, you know, your body liberation you're experiencing. There can still be discomfort with body changes, especially in the upward direction.
Right. Yeah.
Fatness, because of our society's fixation on thinness and health. So, so our approach to care is very much, well, what are the measurable factors? So we look at biochemical data. We look at their food relationship. We look at where they're struggling with meal planning or preparation or eating. We look at mood and mental health, their energy levels, whatever goals they have. And if weight loss is still a goal, we just get more specific. And then again, transparency. We can't guarantee numbers. Like, nobody technically can. Right, they shouldn't be. Yeah. It's a hoax. Your weight may change, but it's also not the most important thing. Mm-hmm. So I've seen time and time again, blood markers improve, for example, for cholesterol or blood pressure with little to no weight changes, but with changes to their lifestyle. So diet, sometimes exercise, just feelings of self-efficacy, like I can do this.
Yeah.
And just working, giving them supports to work through the barriers they have, whether it's, you know, a full-time working parent with a lot of demands, or someone with, you know, a chronic mental health issue, or, you know, a chronic disease. Yeah. So what are the things we can control? Arguably, weight is not one of them that is easily controlled long term. And a lot of people who diet can see, yes, I've fluctuated. I drop and I come up and I drop and I come up. There are the unicorns. So this is about a third or less of the population who will lose weight and keep it off. But based on long term weight loss studies, it's not the majority. Mm. It really isn't. So
yeah, that's a really interesting one, because I remember hearing, I wish I remembered the study. I hope it was a study that I saw this in. But it was something like, even when you reduce the amount of lipids inside a fat cell, the fat cell takes like 9 years before the body metabolizes the cell away. So you've just got like a deflated balloon hanging on there that is ready to fill itself with fats again.
Yes. And
so it takes longer to get bigger if you are also making the fat cells, but if they're left over from previous weight loss, then it's really easy to gain it back really quickly.
Yes, I remember learning that too in my early nutrition classes. And your fat cells can increase in size and number, but they never decrease in number.
Okay.
So once you, if you gain weight, and then therefore I think the theory is that it is easier to gain weight again, because they exist, but I don't exactly know.
Right. No, fair enough.
The rationale, or yeah, like the actual science behind that. Yeah.
You mentioned, do you call it healthy at any size or fit at any size?
Health at every size. And there's a lot of misconceptions about what this means.
Okay.
I don't actually use the term very often, but yes, I would say that I am health at every size aligned. I think one of the misconceptions is that what we're saying is that anyone can be healthy at any size. That's not what health at every size means at all. Health at Every Size recognizes that there can be poor health, especially at the BMI extremes. Mm-hmm. Health at Every Size recognizes that BMI is a very poor marker of health, and that people in the quote unquote normal BMIs can get chronic disease. Mm-hmm. And people in the, say, higher BMIs can also be metabolically healthy.
Yeah, I think my BMI is like 24, something like that, like pretty high.
Okay. So, and yes, it's not appropriate for pregnant people or for people who are bodybuilding and weightlifting, mm-hmm. who retain a lot of muscle. Like, it's just not going to be reflective at all. So that this is another reason why, instead of focusing on weight and BMI, there's so much going on in a person. And again, looking at the whole person and their whole body, you know, in terms of just what's going on in their life, their emotional and mental health, their physical health, so those biochemical markers. Mm-hmm. But even the point is, even if a person's weight is causing poor health, they still deserve dignified health care, and they deserve treatment options that aren't just lose weight, because mm-hmm. it's obviously not being helpful. So I always say to providers, I remind students, providers, even my clients, a great way to think about it is, what is a practitioner recommending to someone in a quote unquote normal BMI or in a smaller body with the same health condition or the same situation as someone in a larger BMI or larger body? So they're not recommended weight loss. So I have a couple of examples just personally. I have heartburn. Most of the time it's silent. We're still trying to figure it out. I also have knee issues, and I had plantar fasciitis and blew I tore my plantar fascia this summer. Oh, it was brutal. So, people in higher weight bodies are told to lose weight for every one of those ailments, mm-hmm. right? What options were I given? We tried multiple medications, inhalers. I'm even getting a pH test next week. I'm getting an NG tube. Physiotherapy to help with mobility, movement, stretching, where to strengthen certain muscles. And the podiatrist assessed my foot. And, you know, mostly I wanted to know if I needed orthotics, and gave me some stretches and exercises and said, just ease into movement, all of those things. Never once was I told to lose weight, and so that's the difference. And so it's giving people actual treatment options. Weight loss is not a treatment, you know, really. And it's, again, because the quote unquote success rate of long-term weight loss is like 30%. What drug would we recommend that has a 30% success rate? It wouldn't even be on the market. So that's one way to look at it. And so that's what we're there to do, is like, okay, your desire for weight loss is valid. And a lot of people come in and they're like, honestly, I just feel pressured to lose weight. I don't care if I lose weight. I just want to feel better. It's like, great, let's focus on that. And so whatever it is that we can encourage them to engage in, we want them to engage in those healthy behaviors.
If that makes sense. You know, it makes total sense. Do you think it's ever a treat? I guess maybe not necessary is the right word.
I know where you're going. Yeah. That's a great question. Yeah. Like, when is weight loss necessary? You know, and I suppose where it becomes, from my perspective, the only time it really becomes necessary is when there's gatekeeping around surgery. So even whether it's gender affirming surgery, or if it's, you know, for breast reduction surgery or knee surgery, like, we are hearing people needing to lose weight, the recommendations from a surgeon's office, the requirement to lose a massive amount of weight before they are granted surgery.
Right.
And so
excuse me.
Often the concern comes down to I think ultimately it comes down to insurance. So if insurance is going to cover it, it's an insurance requirement. Right. And they do this to weed out certain people and to narrow the number of people who can access the surgery. They make claims that it's for all different reasons, you know, safety under anesthetic. The argument that, and there's good scientific study looking at, yes, there are risks to higher weight bodies going under anesthesia, but there are also ways to minimize these risks that a lot of medical students aren't learning because they're not practicing on really high body sizes.
Right.
And B, again, just the bias is, and so there are ways to help minimize the risk. Ultimately, though, I guess my argument is we don't need to, as care providers, and again, this may be controversial, but we don't need to gatekeep. We need to include the client in those conversations and say, here are the risks. Maybe there's even percentages. Maybe there is very high risk. I think the client deserves a conversation to decide whether or not they want to take those risks. Mm. And so there's, again, dignity and respect in those conversations, but also fatter bodies are always going to exist. So medicine needs to do a better job of learning on these fatter bodies, mm. ultimately. Yes.
That makes sense. Is it like a lot of these surgeries, are the reason they want them to lose weight is just gatekeeping? It's just the insurance requirements? Or,
well, like I said, sometimes the claim is safety under anesthesia,
right? Okay.
And again, the risks there.
Yeah.
I have seen, for example, I did a real deep dive into the studies and scientific basis for a BMI cutoff for breast reduction surgery, because I had a handful of clients denied the surgery because their BMI is too high, but they also are just tired of dieting. They've done that. And I will get back to the original question. Sorry, we're getting there. But so ultimately, even with sometimes the claims are recovery and reinfection rates, but there doesn't seem to be a big connection between BMI and infection rates post-recovery. And again, like, you know, most patients are given antibiotics, you know, to help with that. So
Right. Anyway,
what was the original question?
I was just re-asking if it was just gatekeeping was why they were telling people to lose weight before surgeries.
A lot of body liberationists would say that, yes, that's what it is. And there's a lot of science.
Sorry, what's a body liberationist?
Oh, great question. A lot of the science refutes that too. But so body liberation or fat liberation is really just being free of just accepting your body for what it is, but also so when we talk about like body image being a spectrum,
mm-hmm.
where body hatred is on one side and maybe we get to respect, maybe we get to acceptance, maybe we even get to neutral, body liberation is on the far other end where mm-hmm. you just embrace. You might even love the body you're in, although that's not necessarily the goal, but you free yourself from all of the social injustice related to, and you kind of, and so I don't think that's the goal for most people. And sometimes that's not attainable
mm-hmm.
for a lot of reasons, but.
Sorry, yeah, just for my clarification, you don't think it's most people's goal or you don't think that it should be most people's?
Both. Okay. I don't think it's an appropriate goal for everybody. I don't think it's just a realistic goal for everybody. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there can be, especially for people who maybe, for example, don't identify as the gender that they're born into. So, for example, you know, finding body liberation when you don't align with the body that you have. For gender
reasons. Yeah, I imagine that's pretty hard. Yeah.
I'm not explaining it very well, but.
No, I got it now. Yeah. No, that was good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I know that there is a lot, and, you know, working in fertility, there have been recommendations for weight loss before, you know, people in, are granted, say, IVF or in vitro fertilization. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's meet with the client and let's see what's going on. So assessing their diet, looking at the behaviors. So making sure that they're eating frequently enough, making sure that they're, you know, if they are struggling with disordered eating or binge eating, supporting them through that, getting the nutrients they need, maybe adjusting their dietary intake to add more fiber and protein and reduce saturated fat, things like that. Maybe there will be modest weight losses, maybe there won't, but ultimately it's like, okay, we're checking a lot of boxes here. Can you please consider this patient anyway? Because the likelihood of them, you know, losing significant amount of weight seems minimal given their history. They've tried, and it's just like, can you please just talk about the risks with them?
Yeah.
And then let them decide if they want to engage in that. So we, you know, I did work with one client who was successful in having those conversations and was granted the IVF. And yeah, so I think it's just about not just jumping to weight loss conclusions, because we know that the science is super weak and that people deserve a little bit more, I believe you, I trust you, and a more dignity when it comes to treatment options, which are often, you know, therapies, medication, and so on and so forth. Right. Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. I don't want to jump topics. I know I said I wouldn't do this.
We can jump topics. But
it's quarter after, so I got to get you out of here pretty soon, because you have to places to be. But I did want to ask about, because you brought it up about working with people for fertility, and on your biography on your website, you mentioned some of your practice areas or client support areas are like PCOS, fertility, gut disorders, intuitive eating, disordered eating. The two I was most curious about were PCOS and intuitive eating. So I guess quickly with a PCOS, what does it look like going into that conversation and trying to organized nutrition around treating and helping out with that?
So polycystic ovary syndrome is a condition of androgen excess typically, but not always. I mean, so it's diagnosed based on two of three criteria. So the first would be irregular or no periods. So the menstrual cycle can be longer than 35 days or fewer than, you know, 22 days, but very irregular cycle. Signs of excess androgens. So that can be physical signs like hirsutism, which is that face and body hair, that coarse face and body hair growth. Sometimes a male pattern hair baldness. Sometimes signs could also include acne, cystic acne, or in the blood work, we can test for testosterone markers, androgen markers. And then the third would be an ultrasound showing at least one enlarged ovary or multiple cysts on at least one ovary. So, which now we're also seeing, if there's no ultrasound, we can also use anti-Müllerian hormone, which is just part of the most recent guidelines. So working with clients, it's A, really understanding their diagnosis, and what their markers are, B, going through what their goals are. Not everyone with PCOS has the goal of pregnancy. Right. And it's not a condition of infertility. PCOS can affect metabolic health. It can increase the risk of having high triglycerides and lipids like cholesterol. And it can increase the risk of type 2 diabetes. It can increase the risk of fatty liver, you know, non-alcoholic fatty liver. So it's super complicated. And then people have, you know, sometimes drastic weight gains in a really short amount of time, plus all these other symptoms, extreme fatigue, which coincides often with insulin resistance. But it's a really complicated condition.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, endocrine and metabolic conditions. So there's a lot to kind of break down. From there, it would be, I like to talk about the supplements that can be really helpful, whether it's looking at, and again, it would just depend on what we're trying to achieve, but things like myo-inositol, magnesium, maybe vitamin D, omega-3, like those are the four most common that I might be utilizing to help with insulin sensitivity, inflammation, and of course just meeting their needs, mm-hmm. as well as cycle regulation. And then adding key things to the diet. The first I ask is, are you eating enough? Because you can't have a regular cycle if you're constantly undernourished. So, and then secondly, it's adding in fiber, protein, and looking at their patterns. So getting people to eat more regularly every kind of 3 to 4 hours for that blood sugar stability, and adding in key foods that are going to help with insulin sensitization and androgen lowering. So I'm careful not to use the term hormone balance. I know that is a super trendy term, but scientifically, it's I always picture this like fine-tuning, like when you're say a sound person and you've got a soundboard and you're like, you know, balancing all these buttons. That is not what's happening in the body. There are ways to improve some of the hormone markers through diet, exercise, and supplementation. However, it's not like a fine tuning and hormone balance. Like, that's just not a thing.
Yeah, the idea that, well, especially because that it's when I hear that, that kind of sounds like it implies that there's a static mode for your hormones, totally. Which is not true at all.
Right. So, right.
Even testosterone in the male body has a rhythm. Changing. Yeah.
So we know that, you know, FS, follicle stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone can often be very off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know that without ovulation, the progesterone doesn't come up. Like, there's all kinds of things. So we're just sort of working with the best evidence around PCOS, which there is actually a lot when it comes to nutrition science. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it just gives people an extra set of hope. Ultimately, you know, when you're going through fertility treatments, the medications are excellent. They're very powerful. The specialists are super knowledgeable and they're wonderful. And I'm not sure how they feel about the nutrition aspect, but I think when clients are in those spaces, they are wanting to check all the boxes.
Yeah.
We don't know what gets them pregnant in the end. But I just feel if they feel supported with mental health, nutritional well-being, they're being seen and supported at the fertility clinic, and they just have multiple supports, they're just generally going to do better. Overall.
Maybe just like statistically, if you want to look at it from just a math perspective, if you're in something from more angles, and you've got, depending on, obviously some things take away from other things, but you've got more of a chance of trying to hit the nail on the head there.
Totally. Yeah, so it's very careful not to suggest that nutrition should replace medication. I am very pro medication, and we know that there are some excellent ones when it comes to PCOS management. Not everyone wants to go that route, but some people are really glad to hear it. So ultimately, I just want people to know that they have a lot of options. And then again, bringing in the doctor or gynecologist or fertility specialist to further support them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I don't think we have enough time to fully get into intuitive eating, but I guess if you wanted to define it for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, and maybe I should change that on my bio. So like intuitive eating is a sort of a paradigm termed by a couple of dietitian, Elise Resch and Evelyn Tribbley, down in the United States. And so it's based on 10 principles, ultimately kind of looking at tuning into your body, your hunger and fullness cues, you know, using movement as a form of self-care, looking at food satisfaction and ways to help improve that food relationship overall. Gentle nutrition is the last principle because ultimately we're trying to weed through that dieting mentality. What I find is intuitive eating can very much then be used as another diet, I do align with a lot of the principles, but they don't, even though they don't always fit with all of our clients. So I'm very, I use it very loosely, and I use it based on, maybe I might allude to a principle or two if it seems to align with where a client is at. But I think, like anything, when there's a paradigm and there's a set of principles, it can be used very rigidly. So we have to be cautious with that.
Yeah.
And we use a lot of different techniques, motivational with our clients. So motivational interviewing, you know, some cognitive behavioral therapy, and just listening again, just that humanness, human connection. So, yeah. So moving a little bit away from just intuitive eating, and I'm not a certified intuitive eating specialist, but some of the principles, a lot of my clients can really align with. So I'll just sort of cherry pick and use what we need.
Fair enough. Great. Well, I guess where can, people find you or any social media or the website or your, or Food to Fit?
Yeah, I mean, foodtofit.ca is our website. You can find us on Instagram at foodtofit_nutrition, and me personally at Brooke Bulla RD on TikTok and Instagram. But yeah, and I don't post a lot either. I try to get on there, engage, but very much my personal social media, there will be a lot around weight inclusiveness and social justice and anti-racism as the basis of a person's well-being. We know that all of these things affect a person's overall health. So I do share, you know, recipes that I'm putting together because I still have a love for food. And obviously I'm human. I got to eat too. But I try to remove some of that dieting messaging in the things that I share.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share really quickly, or did we... anything I missed?
Oh man, we covered a lot of topics, and you're right. Like, this could be, you know, part A of like, you know, a 5-part series, but nutrition's a huge topic. And, you know, I do also, you know, enjoy talking sport nutrition with some of my clients. That is like where my heart started. And still even relaxing the numbers, but still supporting them with, say, muscle building goals.
Yeah.
I'm an active person myself, so I love the sport nutrition. I love the science. The exercise physiology is fascinating to me, but that would be a whole other, you know, podcast. But yeah.
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 Well, maybe we'll do another one.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great. Thank you for being here. Yeah, you're welcome.